This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and we have an incredible show for you today. The whole world waits in anticipation for the first match tomorrow between Brazil and the Netherlands. And we have for you on today's show the leading English language commentators on the football cultures of both respective countries. First off, we'll hear from Alex Bellos. He is the author of Football, The Brazilian Way of Life. And in the second half of the show, we'll hear the second half of our extended interview with David Winner, author of Brilliant Orange, The Neurotic Genius of Dutch Football. We played the first half of the interview with David Winner a couple days ago. I'll keep you no longer. Up next, Alex Bellos on Brazilian football. It's our turn in July. Though the world's full of problems, they couldn't touch us even if they tried. From the park, I hear rhythm. Marley's caught on the bus. Tonight there will be a party on the corner at the end of the block. Didn't know you would be jamming. This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined now by Alex Bellos, author of the classic book Football, The Brazilian Way of Life. Alex Bellos, welcome to The People's Game.
Hi, nice to be here.
Well, the subject on hand, of course, is the 2010 Brazilian team. You are a historian of football in Brazil, and much has been said about this being one of the most efficient Brazilian sides, and perhaps one that has suppressed the great tradition of flair and beauty in the Brazilian game. So how do you assess the current Brazil side on the eve of their matchup against the Netherlands?
Well, I think they're definitely not one of the most skillful and flamboyant sides, but then still, as we've seen in the recent game against Chile, there is a lot of skill and a lot of potential flamboyance there, especially with the players who play up front. But also, I think it's kind of just a slight myth. It's one of these things that we love to think that the Brazil of the past were just these sort of joyful kind of street children playing for fun. Brazil have always been tough to beat. They've always had good defenders. They've always been very physical. I think that the sort of kind of poetic, sort of artistic flamboyant image is a little bit of a stereotype and not entirely true.
Brazil has produced incredible footballers, obviously 5 World Cups, the incredible legends of Brazilian football. But certainly for, say, English football tradition, Italian football tradition, German football tradition, and even Argentine football tradition, there have been a number of Brazilian players whose ability to sort of dance around opponents and dance around the ball has been very pronounced. And what do you see this?
Absolutely, that's true. And when we think of the great Brazilian players, we don't think of the great Brazilian goalkeepers or even the brilliant defenders. We think of Pelé, Garrincha, Socrates, Careca, Romario, you know, all these are the very attacking, exciting players. I guess my point was just that we shouldn't also forget that they've also had very sort of physical, functional, efficient teams as well. It's just that we've chosen to rather sort of romanticize it, which I think is all part of what we like about soccer, that we form these sort of stereotypes in our brains. But definitely one thing which is happening to the Brazilian game, maybe as a result of globalization, or maybe as a result just of the way that the current crop of players, is that sort of the star players in Europe now of this Brazilian team are the defenders and the goalkeeper.
Right.
You know, the Champions League final, the winners of Internazionale of Milan, Maicon, the defender, Lucio, the Brazilian captain and also defender, and the goalkeeper were in that team, and none of the strikers are in any of the Europe so-called glamour clubs, which is completely opposite to how it's been till up until a few years ago. You know, you'd guarantee that the Brazilian striker would be at AC Milan or Real Madrid or Barcelona, and they're just not.
And the height and strength of the two defenders you mentioned, plus Juan, also seems to stand out in terms of Brazilian football history, at least in terms of the national team. I mean, that's an amazing back line. Do you think this is the best back line in the history of the national team?
They've got a lot going for them in terms of physicality and strength, but also Lucio and Juan have played, I think, for maybe about 6 or 7 years together. So they've got sort of maturity and age. And, you know, Lucio is is a great player, and as well as defend, they call in Brazil the arranque, which is this kind of ability to just come from nowhere, just push forward with sort of incredible strength, like a sort of tractor, through the entire pitch. And, you know, he in the game against Chile, he did that, and almost caused the goal.
Well, it's true that with Maicon, too, just bombing down the right flank, it's very direct. It's almost like a straight line express when these guys get taken off down the field. And it's distinctive. It's certainly effective.
Yeah, and Maicon is really the kind of the true successor of someone like Carlos Alberto, the captain in the famous 1970 team, who was that kind of right back who obviously they've got to defend, but what they're famous for is, you know, running up with incredible speed, power and skill and sort of precision up that right flank. And the most famous goal, really, possibly of all world football, which is the goal that Carlos Alberto scored in the 1970 World Cup final, which, you know, is a goal by a defender rather than, you know, but by a striker. And Maicon, in the very first goal that he scored for Brazil, was kind of reminiscent of that. Just like, you know, in most other teams, someone in his position would be way back defending, but he's there right up goal, scoring goals.
And he had a marvelous season for Inter, who pretty much won almost every match they played down the stretch of the final 2 months of the season, both in the Champions League, the Coppa Italia, and Serie A. And I remember Maicon scored one incredible goal right, I think, in added time one game in Serie A. And again, they needed every point to be able to nip AS Roma in that race.
So, absolutely. I mean, there's one thing, as for an American audience, you might be interested in, because my interest in Brazil is predominantly from the sort of the cultural and historical angle, is that the reason why Maicon is called Maicon, because Maicon is M-A-I-C-O-N, is a sort of Portuguese misspelling of how they think Michael is pronounced. Mm. And his real name, his first two names are Michael Douglas, because he's named after Michael Douglas, the actor. So it's kind of quite funny to think that when people are calling Maicon, it sounds like the sort of, almost like the name of a brand, Maicon. It's actually, they're calling him Michael Douglas.
Well, the Douglas family, going back to Kirk, are actually friends of the radio station that I'm at right now. So let's talk about some of these, the distinct elements of Brazilian soccer culture, which, of course, the whole world is aware of. First off, the one-name tradition, obviously.
Yeah, Pele. Well, the one-name tradition isn't just from Brazilian football,
right.
It is from Brazilian life.
Sure, Lula, and in fact, you get to pick your name as a candidate. And so in the last elections, when Barack Obama was still phenomenally popular in the world, there were, I think, regional elections, and there were tons of people who were running as Obama.
Yeah, I'm sure that's the case. Everyone knows you as your first name in Brazil. So if you wanted to go, for instance, into the record shop, you would find George Michael next to George Benson, because they do it alphabetically by first name. If I was going to be introduced to the president on the most formal occasion, I would be introduced as Alex, not as sort of Mr. Belos. So that is why we all know them by their first names or their nicknames.
But these are generally nicknames with the soccer players.
Well, what you've got is that lots of people have nicknames and they have first names. And it tended to be as a result of, basically, we think it's really lovely and cute, but actually the origins are of Brazil's slave culture, because they had more slaves than anyone else, and they abolished slavery later than anyone else. So the idea of giving someone a nickname because you didn't want to give them a proper name really comes from that. And when the first black and mixed-race players were coming up, they all had nicknames. And one thing which is sort of fascinating is that on the whole, you will find that only the further up the field that you get in Brazilian football, the blacker the team gets, and also the more likely they are to be known by their nicknames. So most Brazilian goalkeepers are known by their surnames. The one that we've got now is known as Julius Caesar. That's Julius Caesar. So that's a pretty strong white name, if ever there was one. And that's his real name.
Yes, I'd say.
And as you go up, you have, you know, your Robinhos and your Kaká, et cetera, et cetera. And in the past, Pelé, Garrincha, they're all these kind of cute nicknames which tend to be on the attacking players. And what's been, quite interestingly, sort of a new phenomenon, which is only about 10 years old, is that defenders have started to be known by having two names. So there's Michel Bastos, Gilberto Silva,
right.
And, you know, some sort of anthropologist and people interested in onomastics, you know, this kind of culture study of people's names, is that what it is that you want to trust someone who's in defense, so you want to know their full name, whereas actually you don't want to trust anyone who's an attacker. You want them to be deceiving. You want them to be sort of getting round people. So that's why there is this sort of the cultural reasons for sort of more nicknames when you players who are further up the field, and more full names, two names, surnames for players more in defensive roles.
I'm speaking with Alex Bellos, the author of Football, the Brazilian Way of Life, on the eve of the showdown between the Netherlands and Brazil. So this team, 2010's Dunga's Brazilian side, Ronaldinho is absent. The great sort of global superstars that dominated the team in 98, 2002, and 2006 are not there this time. I was very impressed with this side actually in the Confederations Cup, something that was got a lot of play in the United States, oddly, because the United States, very oddly, beat Spain in the semifinals. They hadn't done well in the group stages, but America squeaked into the semis, beat Spain, and were up on Brazil 2-0 at halftime. Unlike the Spanish side, the Brazilians went in at halftime. When the Spanish were behind against the Americans, they just acted like this couldn't be happening. They wouldn't put their heart into it. They were just incredulous. The Brazilians, on the other hand, went in at halftime, came in and attacked around the flanks, had a new design to their offense and approached the American defense, and came back and won 3-2. I was very impressed. And what that told me about the team was that they seem to be, and maybe what Dunga's seeking here, is a team that does have that kind of humility, that they're not too big in their own minds about what they are. Do you sense that's true about this Brazilian side?
Yeah, well, I think that the Confederations Cup was the first of a new generation, so they've really got something to prove. I also think that people, again, they like to sort of romanticize that Brazilians, they're maybe temperamental, maybe they're slightly moody, they're just interested in sort of flashy showing off. But actually, that's a kind of misrepresentation of what I think the Brazilians are really like. And there's a saying in Brazil, which is, o brasileiro é sobretudo forte. The Brazilian is a strong man, it's sort of full of grit. And I think that actually the Brazilians are, you know, this image of them just sort of lazing around on beach is not true, and especially the footballers. It is so competitive to become a footballer in Brazil. Right. Not only are there more footballers than anywhere else, the country is bigger than any other great footballing nation. So the only people who succeed are the people who are incredibly tough, and not just physically tough, but mentally strong. And now, since most of them come to Europe aged sort of 16, 17, 18, they've had to survive sort of on their own for several years and really make it. And because you're only seeing the ones that have made it, so these really are sort of supreme athletes who have gone from incredible poverty, and they're winners basically. And I think that Brazil never really get going until they have to get going, because winning is everything. And Dunga has managed to find a group of players who really can do that. You know, when push comes to shove, we say, really get going.
There has been, in previous World Cups, criticism from the Brazilian press that the team is winning, but they're not winning attractively enough. Okay, one, is that happening now? And two, going into this World Cup, there was that sort of accusation that was being leveled and advanced on Dunga's side. So what do you make of Dunga as somebody who's really just not going to give in to that? I mean, the impression in the press is that he's sort of the technocratic, defense-oriented...
Yeah, I mean, it is true. Dunga could have chosen some very creative players, and he didn't.
Right.
And the press in Brazil before the World Cup, they wanted him to call Ronaldinho, and he didn't.
And Neymar.
They wanted to call this new player who's very young, has only been really known for about a year, called Paulo Henrique Ganso, or Goose, was his nickname from Santos. And there were people camping outside his house with flags at Dunga's house saying, you've got to call the guy. And all the papers, you know, it was this big campaign, and Dunga had nothing of it. Mm. So, yes, there is this constant tension. But I think a lot of that is just the media need to sell papers.
Mm-hmm.
And also, because Brazil, they know they're really good. They give themselves the luxury of saying, come on, can't we win slightly better? And what Dunga realizes is that actually Brazilians really want to win. Coming second and playing beautiful football is not as good as winning, playing however you need to play. And you can see that out, that even though people might romanticize about, say, 1982, when they had this great team, they were knocked out by Italy, actually, they're so much more, they are a bit embarrassed by it, and they're so much more proud of 94, where they won, you know, in the States, playing, it wasn't their greatest team at all. You know, very true to this idea, which is, we're going to win, I'm going to choose my team. One of the reasons it came out, really, that they had a great team, all these stars, you know, the most expensive team in the history of football, the last World Cup, and, you know, they were knocked out in the quarterfinals against France, was there were just far too many egos there, and the coach just couldn't, you know, Carlos Alberto Parreira, couldn't sort of keep the egos in control. So he's chosen yes men, he's chosen physically really strong people, he's chosen an overwhelmingly defensive team full of sort of defensive midfielders. But what seems to be happening is that once you have this security at the back, you only need sort of two or three of the silky skilled Brazilians up front, and they can dance and they can do their magic, as we're seeing that they're managing exactly what they're managing to do right now.
It is true, though, you mentioned about the 94 side and the 82 side, that sort of football romantics around the world, really, in talking to David Winter, who part of his interview will be later on in this show, about the 1974 Dutch side, which lost in the finals to Germany. Those two sides, the 74 Dutch side and the 82 Brazilian side, are really heralded by football romantics, but perhaps so much also because they lost. And so there's a sort of a tragic tinge to these
teams.
Yes,
I think that people remember like that, the defeat, in the way that, you know, even say, we remember in the UK, say, Dunkirk, which is when it was kind of defeat, when we all had to come back from France. They call the war much more than almost we remember sort of D-Day, when we kind of attacked and went there. So I think that there is something about the defeat makes countries sort of unite together. And actually, the World Cup, which has sort of psychologically scarred or affected Brazil more than any other, was 1950,
right,
when they hosted it and they lost. So yes, I think we do romanticize and we are sort of affected by those ones. But really, what makes a Brazilian feel proud is being the best in the world, and you become the best in the world not by having the sort of fanciest in the world. You do it by actually bringing home the trophy, and that is the most important.
Well, of course, 1950, I believe, we'll be hearing a lot about in 4 years' time.
Absolutely.
And lastly, the matchup tomorrow, Holland versus Brazil. I've felt when I've watched the Netherlands play in this World Cup, they've sort of decided to stay in third gear so far. They put on that exhibition right before they jumped on the plane to head down to South Africa, where they, you know, really showed off what they can do in terms of pretty play. Robin, of course, got hurt in that game. Robin is back. He does seem to be the one truly exceptional player on that side. So, Brazil versus the Netherlands tomorrow, what do you think? And first off, maybe how do you think the Brazilians will try to contain the player who probably is the hottest offensive performer in the world, even more than Messi these past 3 months in global soccer, Ian Robin?
Well, I think that, firstly, the Brazilians are really worried about this game, much more worried about this game, definitely, than whoever the semi-final would be. But I also think that football is the moment, how things are going, and I think Brazilians are quite confident that they're beginning to gel as a team, that it's beginning to work, that Dunga's tactics, even though they might not like them, are giving results. And they're sort of on a roll now. It is very difficult to score against Brazil, and that's going to carry on being the case. I mean, one slightly non-football thing that I want to say, which is something Brazilians are quite superstitious people that's doing the rounds in Brazil now, is that the parallels between 1994, when Brazil won, are uncannily similar to the games that we've had now. So obviously Brazil met Holland in exactly this place in the quarterfinals in 94 and won. But strangely, the very first game that Brazil had in 94 was they scored two goals against a predominantly communist country in the 20th century, Russia. They scored two goals against North Korea. Their second game, they put three past Cameroon, an African side. This one, the second game, they put three past an African team, the Ivory Coast. Their third game, they played a European team, Sweden, they drew, and the European team came second. The exact happened with Portugal. Mm-hmm. The first round of the last 16 in 94, they played America, an American side. They played Chile. And so people are kind of have got this sort of, oh, it's written in the gods. We've got this momentum. Look how parallel both are. And they're thinking, yes, well, what we did in 94 is that we ended up and we played a former champion and beat them. Well, that's what will probably happen this time, too.
Well, that's a lot of confidence. And I suppose the one thing about Robin we can say is, of course, Julio Cesar, Mike Hahn, and, of course, Lucio, they were able to contain him quite adequately in the Champions League final. So probably they're not too intimidated by his presence on the field. But, again, watching him in the World Cup so far, I felt he has stayed in second gear. And I think he's going to...
Yeah, the entire Dutch team hasn't really done that. But then there's nothing like low expectations for a team to all of a sudden really do well.
Right, and I also think, I don't think Van Bronckhorst could keep up with Mike Hahn or any of the Brazilian players bombing down the right wing. So yeah. There would seem to be some vulnerability on the back line for the Dutch. Would you dare to offer any prognostication about tomorrow?
I think, say, 1-0 Brazil.
Wow.
I think it'll be a difficult game. I don't think it'll be that pretty because I think the stakes are so high. But I think that on paper now and based on form, Brazil are the form team.
Alex Bellos, he is the author of Football, The Brazilian Way of Life. And his new book, by the way, is Here's Looking at Euclid, A Surprising Excursion Through the Astonishing World of Math. And thank you so much, Alex Bellos, for joining us here on The People's Game.
Thank you.
This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky. And now we will hear the second half of the extended interview we did with David Winner, author of Brilliant Orange, The Neurotic Genius of Dutch Football. You can hear the first half of the interview on The People's Game radio show for June 28th. And the entire interview will be posted as a separate file at www.thepeoplesgame.org. Fernando Romero and I spoke with David Winner 3 days ago.
It is perceived that teams like FC Barcelona or even the Dutch national team, where it's perceived that it's more important to play well than to actually win. Can you just explain what exactly happened to the players? Is it just the new generation? Or what happened to the coaching staff? Or what happened to the this mentality that made them actually want to win this time?
First of all, I mean, all the teams that you can say that that's what they ended up doing would deny that that's what they wanted. Because Cruyff, for instance, always says, you do both. You win by being so good, and that involves being beautiful, fine. But the point is to win and, you know, do the things you do best. And we do attacking and creativity. That's what we do best. So he says there's no contradiction.
Right.
But in practice, because it's always hard, it's a bit like Arsene Wenger. Arsene Wenger is a kind of disciple of Cruyff. Pep Guardiola at Barcelona is a complete disciple of Cruyff.
Mm-hmm.
And it ends up, you know, because it's, and so is Van Gaal, though he wouldn't admit it. You know, it's absolutely in that line.
Mm-hmm.
They would never admit it, but it is, because it's harder, the philosophical, moral arguments almost with Wenger sticks to his principles, and the principles are that you play attractive, which is more complicated. Van Gaal plays more attractive.
Mm-hmm.
He's transformed Bayern Munich last season. It's not that they've rejected those values. I think it's just that they've just looked at their history and thought, this is ridiculous that we've never won it. And we're going to go and we're going to try and win it. In mm-hmm. fact, they don't say we're going to try and win it, because that's what they would used to say. They've all said, it's like they're reading from the script, we are here to win it. And what's odd about that is that it's not by any means the most talented group of players. The defense looks weak. And in a funny way, they're playing defensively because the defense is weak. That sounds paradoxical, but because they're not completely secure. In, you know, the 90s teams
mm-hmm.
Played with three defenders often, and you know everybody else is bombing forward. And in fact, the central defender, Danny Blind or Frank de Boer, and earlier it's Ronald Koeman, and earlier it's Ruud Krol. is the central playmaker, because the passing starts and all the attacking movements start from the back with a guy with a great long ball. That's not happening this time. Matthijssen and Heitinger, they're perfectly okay, but they're not in the same mould at all as these great attacking defenders of the past. Right. So to cover those, you know, the basic weakness, and the goalkeeper is okay. He's doing quite well, actually, Stegenberg, but he doesn't inspire the same kind of confidence as Van der Sar, who was there for years. So to cover that, they're operating with two very defensive midfielders, Nigel de Jong and Mark van Bommel, and it's kind of dragging the whole team back. So the weight has somehow shifted. You've got six essentially defensive players, the winger, the fullbacks get forward a lot. And then it's the guys in front sort of have license to be very creative and run around, but it's only the four of them,
right.
And others join. But it's not, the idea has not been that the whole team is on the front foot. It's rather the reverse, and it's odd.
And right, and Kite, he's such a hustle guy. He's not really a guy who, 95% of the time he does get the ball, you're not really expecting beauty from him.
No, he's not beautiful, but he's more effective than you think.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was his run today for the goal that he set up for Snyder, second goal, the killer goal, was very clever, and his control on the head was very nice. And there was another time when he very delicately beat a guy on the wing and charged down like a proper winger. I mean, he was a very good spit centre forward for half a final before he went to Liverpool. He was known for his explosive, more like an English centre forward than a Dutch one, but a sort of explosive finisher, rather dynamic player. Yeah, he's not a great kind of ball artist, but he's no dummy. So yeah, he's quite important to the team, actually. You know, his ethic, his sweating blood for the team. That's, you know, this time round, that's kind of important.
And, of course, Snyder's just won every match he's played in probably for months going back now. I mean, he's had such a run with Inter Milan, and he's a highly confident player right now. It's good that Van Persie is fit again.
Actually, I'll pull you up there, because there's a little bit of a tension between those two. I was talking to a Dutch journalist today who's rather baffled as to why all these colleagues were talking about Van der Vaart and Snyder being the sort of two incompatible elements in the midfield. He's saying the problem is actually Snyder and Van Persie. They see space in a different way, and they don't actually play that well together.
Well, Van Persie was barking at the coach as he came off today.
Yeah, Van Persie is not having a good tournament so far, and he's getting, people in Holland are saying it's because he's not a natural centre forward. I don't think it's that. I think it's he's used to a different kind of movement mm-hmm. around him. At Arsenal, it's relentless attack from every angle, and people switching positions and moving very fluidly. When he plays, I mean, Arsenal missed him very much this season because he was injured for 5 months. But it's not quite the same thing in the Holland team at the moment. It's Sneijder's passing doesn't kind of fit with Van Persie's sense of where he should be, and there's a little bit of tension there. I mean, they don't actually get on personally very well either. Snyder is a very difficult guy. Lots of people don't get on with him. He's also, it's quite interesting that he's completely gone native into Milan. You know, previously Dutch guys would go to Italy and they'd say, you know, this is the way to do it. And they'd order people around and be quite dominating. Even, you know, Brian Roy did it at Foggia a bit, and Ruud Krol at Napoli in the early 80s. Philippe Van Basten and Rijkaard at Milan famously. Snyder's gone the other way. He said, yeah, no, this is good. I used to waste a lot of time trying to look cool. I'm just going to work completely for the team. He signed up totally for Mourinho's tactics and philosophy of the game. And he's even announced in an interview, I think at the end of last week, he's converted to Catholicism. He says the rosary every day on the phone. With his incredibly glamorous girlfriend called Yolanta, something like that. I forget her name. She's staggeringly gorgeous.
Yes.
Dutch TV presenter. Anyway, he's gone completely Italian.
I want to go back to perhaps the most famous game in the history of Dutch football, which is the 1974 final. What's your interpretation of what happened in that game? Because for the first 3 minutes of the game. Germany didn't touch the ball, and Holland scored on a penalty kick, and it was the apex of a team that was mesmerizing the world. Yet, almost in the kind of tragic, dramatic sense, in this sort of flatter, less joyous forces won the match in Germany. So just your reflections on that match.
Well, I've never got over it. I really have never got over it. You mention it. You mentioned the date. You mentioned it. And a little sort of wave of pain and regret came through me. And it always does. Every time I think of it, it's like the Kennedy assassination. It's a moment of, you get a tragedy in the Greek drama sense. You can't say it another way. It plugs into all our romantic, as in romantic movement, ideas of, you know, what the ultimate tragic hero or right. tragic figure, the one that moves us the most is the kind of the beauty struck down, the more beautiful, the more talented, the more the more unfair the ending, the more unexpected or indeed suicide. That's no bar to iconic status. You know, Kurt Cobain is loved more than anybody else from that generation. And it's still a pang. You can't think of Kurt Cobain without feeling a pang. It's the same with John Lennon. It's the same with, you know, Marilyn Monroe. It's slightly different, but it's, you know, Greta Garbo has got much greater status than Barbara Stanwyck. And Barbara Stanwyck was a much better actress. You know, but Garbo left the building. And that's what happened with the Dutch. They were the best. Probably, people talk about the Hungarians of 53 and 64, the Pelé team, the Pelé Brazil of 1970. But along with those two, the Dutch of 1974 were simply the greatest team that's ever played. And there are DVDs of their games through that tournament on sale. You can buy the whole set for like 100 euros. And it's a good watch. You know, it's still moving. It's still incredibly beautiful and stylish and funny and electrifying. Even though the pace of the game has changed, you adapt slightly, and it's amazing stuff. All through the tournament, they play the most fantastic football.
Oh. On YouTube, the Cruyff mashups are astonishing.
It is. It's thrilling stuff. My favorite one on YouTube is Holland Uruguay from the first game.
Yeah. Yes.
And it's like 5 or 6 minutes. And they haven't just picked out the goals. They've picked out lots of little cameos and things like catching the Uruguayans, like 5, 6 Uruguayans at a time offside. There's a moment where Van Hanegem, who is he was a Feyenoord player, and he was slow moving, but very, very brilliant with his passing. I mean, astonishing passing, and a tough guy as well. And he's now he didn't really make it as a coach, but he's a much loved TV sort of analyst and newspaper columnist on football. And there's a moment where the Uruguayans who were being quite thuggish because there was no other way to stop the Dutch thing, somebody tried to sort of barge him over, and the guy just bounces off him and falls like a broken doll. And to compound the physical insult, he then Van Hanegem backheels the ball to a colleague. So it's like complete contempt for this guy and total superiority. The whole tournament was like that. And then they start the game against the Germans, score without the Germans even touching the ball. And then hubris, the thing that leads to downfall and Greek tragedy, sets in. And because the history plays a part as well, this is this is 30 years after the war. The war is fresh. For these historical reasons, as Brian Glanville put it, you know, historical reasons, they yearn to humiliate the Germans. And instead of going for another goal and finishing off the game, they taunt them, they make patterns, they just show off for the next 20, 25 minutes in the game. And the Germans were not to be trifled with. They were a fantastic side themselves, not quite as good as the Dutch. And they possessed in Franz Beckenbauer, probably the greatest defender of all time, one of, and then Gerd Müller, the greatest goal scorer of all time. And the Germans fought back and scored two goals. One of them a disputed penalty, which was probably, you know, it was fair enough to give. And it was 2-1 at half time. In the second half, the Dutch rallied, but they just couldn't score again. And in fact, the Germans scored again, a goal that was perfectly good but was wrongly disallowed, Gerdmüller again. And they did it to themselves. And we now know from a book, ironically, entitled 1974, We Were the Best, mm-hmm. which was a bit of a bestseller 6 years ago in Holland on the 30th anniversary. He went round every journalist called Alkekok, went round to Holland and Germany and spoke to every eyewitness. People, there was an incident at the hotel that was reported. Naked German girls had been seen in the hotel swimming pool with frolicking with Dutch players, and the report of that was blamed. It appeared in Germany, and it was said that this caused problems in the Dutch camp, and it was also said by Michels himself, the coach, that this was a German smear story, you know, that the German press were trying to destroy the Dutch, when actually none of that was. The only thing that was true was the story itself. They were frolicking, and there was quite a lot of frolicking. The discipline had gone. They were living somewhat like rock stars in that hotel. And they thought they'd done the hard part by beating Brazil in the semifinal. Mm-hmm. And they just didn't prepare right. And the mentality, everything was wrong. And that's why they lost. And they've never got over it. That's a very long answer, but that's...
I suppose to wrap up the conversation on Holland, there'll just be two more questions I have. The Brilliant Orange is the title of your book, David Winner. And then the subtitle includes The Genius of Dutch Soccer. Okay, we all see that, but the full subtitle is The Neurotic Genius of Dutch Soccer. Explain neuroses and why you use that word.
Well, because you could almost say the pathology of pathological genius. I mean, it's dysfunctional. They have all this brilliance, but they also undermine it in all sorts of strange and interesting ways. I alluded to it earlier, but the history of Dutch self-inflicted defeats, 74 is the template, but it goes all the way through from then, and it's clearly neurotic.
The era that we're in now, in contrast to the 60s and 70s, sort of efficient technocratic management, Holland versus Brazil, both sides... according to your analysis of this year's Dutch team and what everybody has said about Dunga's Brazil, are trying to put the genius of their national soccer side somewhat dampen them, and in terms of the Dutch, dampen the neurotic and pathological sides for the purpose of efficiency and winning. What's your expectation for the match?
I'm fearful for Holland because Brazil looked very good. It could also be... an extraordinary classic. You just don't know. The game that it looks most like going into it is the 94. They've met three times in the World Cup, and each time has been pretty interesting. 94 was the most cautious for the first half. Mm-hmm. Dutch were really in awe of Brazil, which they shouldn't have been, and didn't really dare come out. And then they suffered two quick goals against them, and then they just forgot all their tactics and just went for it. And scored two quick goals, most fantastic comeback, and then the game was settled by a sort of disputed free kick and a long-range free kick by Branco that should have been saved, probably. But it was a great, great second half. It was probably the best game, or one of the best games of that World Cup, and it could be the same again. I think if Holland can throw off their caution and play to their genius, which they have at least one authentic genius in Arjen Robben, now restored to fitness, and they have several support players who are almost as good. If they can play to that strength, they can trouble Brazil, I think. Brazil are very strong defensively, much stronger than Holland. I don't think it suits the Dutch to sit back and wait to be attacked. And you can't pick off Brazil in the way you can pick off Japan or Slovakia. They have to go for it a bit. Brazil, in the short time today that they were being pressed in the beginning of the game by Chile, they didn't look totally convincing. The problem was that Chile's attacks tended to sort of peter out, and these skillful players would run into banks of Brazilian defenders instead of passing into space. Holland didn't have to do that, and I thought Portugal pressed Brazil rather effectively the other day. So I think Holland's best form of defense is attack. Whether they'll do it, I don't know. I hope.
I often, because I'm a suppose I'm a knee-jerk leftist, have rooted for sides sort of due to the political configurations of the societies at the time. One of the teams I, of course, rooted most passionately for was Holland against Argentina in 1978, which, of course, has a whole set of sub-stories to it. Holland these days, though, I think you're correct. The sort of political narrative that comes out of Holland is, while I don't believe that there's none of the major parties are undermining the welfare state, the sort of headlines that come out have to do with the sort of surprising reemergence from this, what was known of for the past few decades as an extremely liberal society, of a form of nativism.
Sure, that's absolutely what's happening. There's been a racist side to Holland, a dark side. It was, if you know your history about Holland, they were one of the big collaborator nations.
Right.
They wanted to talk about during the war. Your chances as a Jew, for example, in Amsterdam were about twice as bad in Amsterdam as they were in France, where there's a lot of post-war soul-searching, and the police chiefs of Paris were rightly condemned and examined in great detail what they'd done. But the police chief in Amsterdam, a man called Siebren Tulp, was much worse. So there's always been the Dutch are quite good at sort of self-promoting, and they haven't drawn attention to this. The current slightly darker sort of sense that you get out of Holland since Pim Fortuyn, really, on the other, is in tune a bit with that. On the other hand, they would say that they are the defenders of precisely the kind of liberalism
that
you warm to, in that, you know, Pim Fortuyn said, you know, I'm not racist, I'm not against anybody, but I just don't like this very intolerant brand of Islam that's coming into Holland, and it's not compatible with our values, and I'm a gay man, and I don't want us to have to go through all the battles we went through in the 50s and 60s, 70s to win equal rights and so on. We don't want to have to do all that again with Islam.
Right. It's a stunningly out of tune argument.
Look,
but,
it's not just nativist. It's not like a Jörg Haider phenomenon.
Right.
Because, I mean, even Geert Wilders, there's not an attractive party, and he's not an attractive personality, but he doesn't say, you know, sort of classic racist things at all. He pitches it all in terms of, I am defending the liberal freedoms that we've had, and multiculturalism isn't what we thought it was going to be. It's produced these problems, and that's actually a problem it's a discussion, let's say, one is entitled to have across, you know, the Western world, probably. How does one deal with all this? And because mainstream parties have tended to not want to have that conversation, partly because of that you're having this, but there isn't, absolutely, there's a nativist and rather unpleasant and distinctly racist aspect to it as well.
Well, one of the peculiarities, especially in the 1980s when I was a student at university, and there was a huge, you know, anti-apartheid movement across the world, as you know, you'd look at Holland and see at that point, you know, this sort of unwaveringly liberal society. And then you look down to South Africa and you had the descendants of the Dutch making up the balance of the most virulent defenders of apartheid. And so this World Cup is taking place in South Africa. And, you know, it's all subtextual, but it's something of an odd fit.
Well, there's also you could point to the very brutal colonial war that the Dutch fought in Indonesia after they'd been occupied themselves. It's not a pretty story.
Right.
No, I mean, there it is. It's the Dutch aren't as adorable as, you know, they are adorable. I love them very dearly. I mean, it's often said, for example, about Anne Frank, you know, that she's actually she's not Dutch. She's German, and she's betrayed by the Dutch. By several Dutch people, which is a bit like the thing they say about Germany and Austria after the war. Austrians managed to persuade everybody that Beethoven was Austrian and Hitler was German. Whereas actually, it was the other way around.
Right. Well, and they put the capital in Bonn after the war because what positive national symbol could they come up with except Beethoven? You mentioned Anne Frank, and I want to move on to talk just briefly about the British national side before we let you go. But in mentioning Anne Frank...
What's the connection between Anne Frank and the English side?
Oh, no. Anne Frank relates, though, to Johan Cruyff in this manner, which is that if you think about Johan Cruyff and then later Van Basten, but particularly Cruyff now, okay, Anne Frank, Rembrandt, Van Gogh are probably the three Dutch people who would come to mind at least first for somebody who goes through an American high school education as being the most famous Dutch people from history. You probably haven't heard much about Spinoza, right? But
right.
In the world, and I think this is something that is lost on Americans, that Johan Cruyff is probably the most famous and almost certainly the most celebrated post-war Dutch person. Am I correct in that?
Absolutely. And he's the most important Dutch person for the Dutch. No question about it. No question about it. I've tried to persuade the Dutch foreign ministry, for example. I said, you know, you are crazy. They promote their culture through people like Rem Koolhaas, the architect, and Harry Mulisch, the writer, and other people that almost nobody's heard of. And I say, you are nuts. You should do what the Brazilians have done with Pelé and what the Germans did with Beckenbauer and what the English have done more recently with David Beckham. You know, your footballers are the most fantastic advertisement for your country. You couldn't buy it. You know, they define the country in the most lovely way. And you should be showering attention on these guys and promoting them and so on. And, I mean, some of the 70s guys who are my heroes, Cruyff is very well known and very successful and so on, but some of them, you know, they live quite in a modest way and they've largely been forgotten. People like Rensenbrink and Johnny Rep, you know, they're still great guys.
And really, they came a crossbar away from winning the title, the World Cup in South America. They would be the only European side to have won out of Europe. And they were doing it without Cruyff, who at the time at least, declared that he would not go to play in Argentina because there was a fascist dictatorship there. And
that was never the case, by the way, because he announced right after the 74 tournament, when there was no dirty war, there was nobody knew the name of Videla, and there was no junta, there was no campaign of mass torture and mass killing. There was no death, not death camp exactly, but the mechanics school, which is as close to the main stadium where the final was in Buenos Aires as Wembley Park tube station is from Wembley Stadium in London, within screaming distance, this place where people were systematically tortured to death, thousands of them, including during the tournament. None of that was happening, and none of that was even known to be in the future. And even then, Cruyff said he wouldn't go. We don't know. He claims it's because his family was held by robbers at knife point
in Barcelona.
I forget, in Barcelona, and that's why he didn't go. But nobody really knows for sure. It could be, you know, this sort of the residue of the swimming pool incident in 74. That's the common theory.
But still, it's a nice political gesture.
They did come very, very. I mean, what I now know about the 78 tournament, I mean, it should never have been played. It was a terrible thing, and it because the Argentine junta kind of influenced events on the field, let's put it like that, and there's lots of instances of cheating and unsavory behaviour, and you know, and it ended up with Argentina winning, and the euphoria that produced in the country kept the junta in power for another 4 years. A lot of people died because of that World Cup, but having said all that. Yes, Holland came within a millimeter of winning the game with the last kick almost when Rensenbrink hit the post. And then in the second half, in extra time, the Argentines came out and scored another two goals in a very, very strange game. And nobody's explained how the Argentines, who looked dead at the end of 90 minutes, suddenly came out supercharged for extra time. It was all very peculiar, and they were doing horrible things. They were catching the ball and cheating, and it was just an awful, awful final.
And Maradona was already a sensation, not included in the side, and of course would redeem Argentine football in 86. But you wrote a book after you wrote Brilliant Orange called Those Feet, A Sensual History of English Football. And your book on Dutch soccer is so exceptional and so sublime, and you have the turf there in many respects to yourself in the manner of the book, at least in English. Of course, trying to write books on when one writes a book about English football, there's libraries full of books on English football. And British national side this year, I could not possibly believe that a team from England made up of stars from the Premiership could be that bad. I mean, they were...
I have to correct you. It's not the British national side.
Sorry, yes.
Scotland, Ireland, and Wales would get very pissed off about that.
Yes. David Winter, you followed up Brilliant Orange, the neurotic genius of Dutch soccer, with another work on football, Those Feet, Essential History of English Football. I'm guessing from your accent that you are an English national. The 2010 World Cup has to go down as a nadir in the history of English football. I mean, I think they really performed better in the 2008 Euro Championship, which they didn't qualify for, than they did in the 2010 World Cup. That was really horrible. What are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I was. Everybody in England has been trying to kind of work out how bad that was. You should understand that we have developed over the decades of underachievement. It starts a long way back. It starts in 1953 when England lose for the first time to a foreign team on English soil to the Hungarians. And so it's the defining moment of English football. And then it's sort of the lesson of that game was that the insular, arrogant, blinkered England had been taught a great lesson by innovators on the continent, as we put it. You know, the Europeans had come and shown that they'd learned football and they'd learned to play it better than we did ourselves. And that was a great shock, and we solemnly affirmed that we would never be caught in this way again, and we would learn, and never happened. And time and again over the last, well, since 1953, English teams have come a cropper in precisely the same way as they did this time. And it's bewildering, really, that a pattern can repeat itself so persistently. The gulf between what they should have been and what they were was particularly odd this time. See players, I mean, we know that Gerrard and Lampard don't play that well together, but see Rooney lumbering around like a lost sheep. It's just strange. He's a lion to Manchester United, and there he was. Just, you know, he'd look happier on a Welsh hillside. Really, he looked very unhappy. It was inept. It was embarrassing. It was very odd. And I think by now it's become a problem of the way that we in England approach the national team. You know, we burden it with all the expectations and all the anxieties that come from it being sort of, it's our ersatz lost empire. We've never talked about the loss of empire as a national trauma, which it clearly was, but we talked about it instead through sport, primarily football, primarily soccer, and the failure of the national team to do much after winning the World Cup in 1966, which was a redemption for 1953, and losing to the Americans also in 1950, though that was barely noticed at the time. But the decline since 66 became tied up with the sense that England had fallen as a great power. And so now it's very strange being in Italy and following the English coverage. It accentuates something I've already known and I write about in Those Feet, about how we imbue football with a whole language of military metaphors and national pride and national virility and national masculinity, without getting anywhere near, you know, gender studies or something, which I don't like. But that's the kind of stuff that's going on. So it's all about battle and a famous, slightly hammy, very hammy actually, but sort of lovable old actor called Brian Blessed was on the BBC coverage. I was watching the BBC coverage in an Italian pub, mm-hmm. which was even strange. And he was reciting before the game what was the speech from Henry V, God for Harry, England and St. George. And it was just kind of, this doesn't work in World Cup. You know, you should be talking about technicalities of football, about not just sort of charge and get into them, and Fabio Capello's troops. You know, that would be another one. I think that's part of the problem, because the players shrivel somehow. They're big egos, they're arrogant and so on, but then they feel the weight of all this expectation. And it, as Fabio Capello says, you know, the shirt has become very heavy. And they put it on, and they just They played with no confidence. I mean, they looked like they'd just been introduced to each other 10 minutes before kickoff. It was horrible.
Yeah, I think as time passes, I mean, a lot will hinge on Rooney, but there was almost nothing there from anybody. And the main thing.
Many times the defending, again, because it plugs into the war and it's the Germans, it was quite witty today. Richard Littlejohn in the Daily Mail said, you know, if the few, it's a reference to the Battle of Britain, won by the few, the Spitfire pilots and so on. So if the few had defended like this against Germany, we'd all be speaking German now.
Yeah.
But again, you know, cast it in terms of the war and lost pride and the English chant, two world wars, one world cup. You know, it's like embarrassing now.
Yeah, it was.
Germany is not the Germany even of post-war. It's a very different Germany. And please don't go on about it. It doesn't help them or us, or it particularly doesn't help us.
Looking at the rest of the tournament before we let you go, first off, Argentina-Germany. Your thoughts on Diego Maradona's Argentina?
They're very good, aren't they? They haven't really been put under pressure yet. Last World Cup, I went round the world watching people watch the World Cup because I thought, well, you know, the event is a television event. It doesn't really matter what happens in the stadium. That people in there are like the TV audience in the studio. Mm. And the real show, the real cultural meat of the thing, real event, is millions, countless millions of people watching in pubs and piazzas and, you know, great public spaces and private homes on all around the planet. And that's, I ended up in Buenos Aires on my round the world thing, watching Germany, Argentina in a bar in Buenos Aires, like an hour after I got off the plane. I formed an unexpected deep bond. Not that deep, actually, but I mean, it's an unexpectedly deep bond and deep sense of affection for Argentina and the pain of the people who were watching that afternoon. It was very moving. I felt their pain and their joy, and I kind of rooting for Argentina a bit this time. I mean, Maradona, he's a hate figure for a lot of English people. They remember the infamous hand of God.
Oh, sure.
About which too much has been said. And
redemption for the Falklands War, too, in one football match.
We don't care about that. We absolutely don't care about that.
Well, they cared a little bit down there. But again, they knocked out the fascist dictatorship. So,
but in mainland England, we really didn't care. We only talk about the hand of God, and we mock him for his drug taking and his madness and all that. But there's something about him that you can't help but love.
Oh, doesn't a person like that and Cruyff, they're possessed of real human genius.
Total genius. And you can't expect a genius to be, you know, well balanced. It just doesn't go with the territory, does it?
No.
I mean, he's very extreme. Pelé and he probably deserve to be considered equal. Pelé is much the more sort of amiable, or at least there's no comparison. He's an amiable, sweet. Mm-hmm. Everybody likes him. But he's much less interesting, isn't he?
Yeah. Well, again, I've been bantering around the idea of a Faustian pact with Diego Maradona. Especially after they were so wretched in qualifying. And now all of a sudden, here's this team which had no cohesion, 100-plus players tried on the squad during qualifying. Now they're totally cohesive. The exclusions seem to have helped in terms of team unity, leaving off, you know, Cambiaso, Zanetti after they win the European Championship. Of course, Raquel May's long gone. Melito's on the bench versus Higuain, which doesn't seem to make
sense. After the season he had.
But I've now posited the notion that he's not Faust, but he's the Lord of the Underworld himself.
he is Sauron, Lord of Mordor, isn't he?
What do you make of Germany, though? Because that team has great skill and speed and the athleticism, as always.
Delightful. I mean, it's, again, a confounding of all the old stereotypes about the efficient Teutonic, you know, tedious oppression of German teams, playing just delicious, attacking, beautifully balanced, clever football, and there are hardly any Germans in the team.
Yes, that's true.
The best player is a Turk, and it's very cool. And Joachim Löw is a sort of cool metrosexual guy. He's, you know, you couldn't get further from Sepp Herberger, the architect of the post-war German ethos. in football, the guy who steers the 54 team to unexpected victory against the Hungarians, who is the font of, with, you know, things like the ball is round, the next game is the most important, all these kind of workmanlike but, you know, quite effective philosophical aphorisms about football. They're all from him. And Love is just a different character, a different image altogether. It's, again, looking from a Dutch perspective, it's kind of weird that the Germans are now playing the attractive modern football and the Dutch playing this rather cool, calculating percentage-type football. But I think in the Dutch case, it's more just, you know, a desperate attempt to overcome past traumas than anything else. No, I mean, I like the Germans very much. They were so superior against England. The over the line goal wasn't really here or there, most people think.
Right.
Yeah, no, they're great.
And last country I'll ask you about, because obviously here in the United States, and I don't know if you're aware of this, but the popularity of the World Cup on television, I think it's like 60% up, depending on how you cut, slice and dice it, and you mix in the Spanish language television viewership plus the English language, it's maybe doubling previous World Cups. The team played a set of dramatic games. What do you make of this year's Team USA, and what's your sense from where you sit, obviously, as a preeminent soccer historian and sort of cultural analyst of global soccer? What do you make of soccer or football, as it were, in the USA right now?
I happened to be in New York during the 1990 World Cup, watching Spanish channel, Univision.
Mm-hmm.
Univision. Is it still going? I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
And Andres Cantor was the commentator, wasn't he?
Yes. From a studio in Miami, I think.
From a studio in Miami, sure, or LA or where it was. Mm-hmm. But he certainly wasn't in Italy watching the games, but it was great. But I felt the loneliest man in the universe, because there's a couple of Egyptian guys down the road in a pizza place, and we bonded like brothers because we were the only people we knew in New York who cared about soccer and the World Cup. And I remember very vividly watching the England-Germany semi-final that year, which was a fantastic, emotional, amazing game. It was also July 4th. And my friends kept sort of bothering me all through the, you know, second half and extra time and penalties. They're like, come on, we're going to go to the party. You know, I think you don't understand. This is one of the most important days mm-hmm. in world history, certainly in my life. But, you know, there was no comprehension at all of what a World Cup was. There must have been a few isolated pockets of people like me in the city. It's now completely transformed. You can have a conversation with pretty much any American. People, friends are in New York, in LA, all over the States, who know a good deal about football. We still call it soccer, but it's a complete transformation. And I was watching the Slovenia-US game in a bar in Rome, which was full of young Americans.
Mm.
And it was a fantastic atmosphere, and they completely got everything. And when the equalizer came, it was, you know, USA, USA, it was great. And then they were as upset as any other fans would be when the winning goal was stolen from them at the end. And even afterwards, you could see people in the team shirts walking around in the center of Rome. And I chatted with some of them. And, you know, it's exactly as it would have been with any other soccer fan from anywhere in the world. So it's completely, America has joined the rest of the world on increasingly equal terms, because the Team USA was pretty good. On the other hand, it also lacked that thing that makes difference between a sort of competent, efficient, serviceable kind of team and proper quality team that's going to win things and win hearts. There just wasn't enough creativity when it came to it against Ghana. I think that was the problem, that you don't have the kind of creative players that the Brazilians, the Argentines, the Dutch, and a few other nations have, who've just simply been playing the game longer
mm-hmm.
and have developed it. There's also this thing, I remember when I was trying to get Brilliant Orange published in the States, mm-hmm. I was looking at there was a lot of books being written in the States, and a lot of them seemed to be completely missing the point. There'd be kind of, you know, 50 restart plays by such and such a coach.
Mm.
Or you'd pick out something, which was the way you would approach, I guess, American football. But it most certainly doesn't work you just can't do that with soccer. And if you start trying to do it, it means you've missed the point somehow. Mm-hmm. But it's a much more fluid thing, and it's actually quite hard to define. It's almost impossible. It's pointless actually to kind of restart plays. I mean, you can have strategies for corners, free kicks, and so on, but that's not what the game is about. So that I was struck by. But that's like a cultural thing. You come from a different background. Mm-hmm. The Japanese also, for example, have some cultural baggage which stops them playing soccer as effectively as they probably will do, in another few years. Namely, the sort of samurai, post-samurai thing where it's considered a bit shameful. This is weird, a bit shameful to shoot, to sort of be selfish enough to want to hog the glory of actually scoring a goal. So Japanese technical play is very good, but they don't score enough goals. It's in the J-League, it's a lot of foreigners who sort of score most of the goals. That's weird, I think you'd agree, but they'll get over that. And America will be producing players who are less fixated and coaches who are less fixated with the sort of athletic and plannable, if that's a word, aspects of the game. It'll be more fluid, and you'll get into the more sort of spontaneous sort of sensing of patterns, and passing is a set of relationships that sort of build on a field, and it's very fluid. It's really hard to, it's quite hard to define, but you sort of, it's a bit like the offside rules. There's a nice German film about the offside, called Offside, and at the end it's sort of like a bend it like Beckham story, and at the end you understand why it's called offside. The filmmaker asks people in the streets to define the offside rule, and none of them can really do it. So somebody says, it's like love. It's very hard to explain, but you know it when you see it. Soccer is a bit like that. There's a certain point where you just get it. You think, it should be like that, and that's in the wrong position because you can't necessarily put it into words. You just feel it, and that's a feeling that the older soccer countries have, and you will acquire it, and you are, you're developing at a phenomenal rate. And, it's still a minority sport, I know, but it's a very large minority, and there's more people playing soccer than live in the Netherlands, in the States. So you've got a fair old momentum going, I think. And Team USA, if that's the correct way to call it, will get better and better, I'm sure of it.
Yeah, according to Simon Cooper from the Financial Times, there are more organized youth soccer players in the United States than any country in the world. And by the way, I have to let you go. I know it's late there, and we're sort of on to global football. Have you ever traveled to India and looked at football culture there? We're going to do a little research on this in the next few days. Maybe I'll bracket this and not include this in the interview, but have you ever gone there, and how popular is football in India?
I've never been there, and I don't know, but I did some research on this a while back and discovered that the biggest local derby game anywhere in the world is in India, and I forget even which cities it's in. But it's two teams you've never heard of, and they play in front of like 130,000 people, crazy with passion. It's not the major sport. It's not like cricket,
right?
But like everywhere else, it's they see, the global television is changing everything,
right?
And football becomes the global language in a way that we've never seen since silent cinema. It's football, soccer is much bigger now than pop music, rock or whatever, popular music, which is very different in each country. Though in America and England, we tend to think it's not. But in a country like Italy, for example, it doesn't penetrate all. I mean, there's a huge local thing, and it is all over the world. But soccer, global language, it's completely. It's as close to being universal as we've had.
Right.
It cuts across language, culture, climate, cuts across everything. And right. It's completely, it was one of the things I sort of knew already, but I didn't know it until I saw it, that people in completely different countries all understand this language in identical way. But there are different styles, but actually they're less important than you think they're going to be. And it's like, it's as if you enter a different space when a game comes on, especially World Cup game that everybody's watching. You all speak the same language because you're all following the same thing and you know what it means. Somehow encodes very deep rituals and meanings in, but very, very deep in humanity. And it can't be an accident that soccer, more than any other sport, has come to dominate the world in the way that it does, without being a kind of, I mean, even though FIFA is totally obnoxious and corrupt and all the rest, even people like Sepp Blatter can't ruin football. It's amazing. And it keeps growing.
Yeah,
it's got nothing to do with them. One of the things I really hate is the FIFA World Cup, FIFA TM, FIFA World Cup TM, and they're trying to brand everything in this very unsavory, megalomaniac, actually, thing with the orange-clad Dutch girls who are promoting a Bavaria beer instead of the official beer. And they ended up in jail, in a court. It's mad. So I'm not a big fan of FIFA in all sorts of ways, but they cannot sort of disrupt the essential magic of the thing, which is that everybody can play it, everybody understands it. It's very simple, but very profound somehow. It can get very complicated, but it's very simple. It is a global language. We're in new territory here, and we all need to kind of speak the language a bit. And at the same time, it's kind of a little bit worrying that people only talk about football and lose sight of other things. And it has a bit of a squashing effect around the world as well. Mm-hmm. That's not so good. But it's very powerful. And I'm surprised that other people, I'm surprised there are not more academics and not more intellectuals sort of really getting interested in it. It is interesting.
Actually, here in the United States, both at a local university here in the Pomona College Group, there were two professors who had a global football course, and at Duke University in North Carolina, Laurent Dubois had a World Cup and World Politics course. The course at the Pomona Colleges was the most popular course, I was told, ever. I'm not sure if that's accurate, but at least in recent memory at the university. It's interesting, too, because the sort of geopolitics of soccer, which in a sense you hinted at in the sort of squashing effect you mentioned, it is somewhat inverted here, because I've made this argument consistently throughout this show, that in the United States, anything that brings global football to the United States has, I can dream of whatever kind of nicer, socialist economy that I'd like to see occur, nice humanist socialism, participatory democratic socialism, nothing nasty there. In the States, on a much simpler plane, you have the right-wing Fox News railing against football because it's unmanly, it's un-American. What else are they saying? Socialist. They're saying it's socialist, which is, of course, ridiculous. But it's this red state, blue state divide. And, of course, it is along sort of an internationalist of the internationalists of the blue states, right? The people who got into Obama for the notion of a hope and change that was not the Bush administration versus the Sarah Palins and the Bushes who are invested for their, political future for this kind of insulated nativism that then becomes about, baseball, basketball, football, and the exclusion of soccer. So, the entry into the global community and the global language of soccer has this clear, and by the way, I think Fox News is basically right. They do have to fear this, at least in the context of the United States, that this is, as the imperial hegemon, when we go out and we blitz and we kill people, that's predicated on their dehumanization, and global football, is going to not allow that.
It's interesting that it can be. That was news to me, actually. I sort of picked it up slightly that there was on the comedian circuit. There's a slight argument going on in America about soccer, which again is new, and it's an indication that it's growing because it used to be, it just barely registered. Even when it was in the States, when the World Cup was actually staged in America, it didn't impact that much. Now it's been transformed. And I remember, I think it's probably a famous article by somebody, can't remember the name, but it's somebody noted a few years ago about the vast amounts of money that baseball and American football had spent trying to kind of promote themselves around the world, and instead, without a huge amount of and the World Cup and FIFA marketing and other people have been trying to market soccer in the other direction. But the weight was very much on traditional American sports. And in fact, what had happened was that soccer had come to America and lots of people had taken it up and people were going to bars and wearing shirts, especially at World Cup time. And that was unexpected. It demonstrates the thing I was saying earlier, that the very simplicity of it and the way that it's not complicated. There are a few statistics, but they're not that interesting, not that important. It's not a numbers game in the way that some American sports are. It's just really straightforward, really primal at the same time. It's hard to stop. And if I was American, I would be a bit upset about it. I'm not very nostalgic. I mean, for example, baseball, I think is a wonderful game. It's got, it does have all these deep rhythms and subtleties and things. Like cricket as well, which, it's a nice distinction between America and England, but we just basically don't get each other's bat and ball games. But they're very deep and they're very beautiful, and it would be a shame, as happened in the West Indies, in Jamaica and Barbados and places like that, which used to have, basically it was a cricket culture, and soccer and basketball have come in and hugely diminished it. Is that a good thing? I'm not sure it is, really. I like more the merrier, more different approaches the merrier. I mean, maybe Japan should not take up soccer. Maybe stick with, sumo and stuff. And it's nice that other people do different things. So in some ways, it's a flattening. It's the globalization, the fact that everybody's going to be watching the same thing is a bit sad.
Well,
two different things, and it's very interesting. In Iran, for example, it's said that after the 1998 World Cup, when Iran beat America, beat USA and France, the regime in Tehran took that. They were expecting one thing, that it was going to be a bit of a propaganda thing. But what actually happened was that there was fraternization and warmth between the Iranian and U.S. soccer players. That was one thing. And the spectators as well. And they made quite sure that they didn't qualify for the next one or for this one. It is said that the regime doesn't want there to be, that soccer has a humanizing... Exactly what you were saying earlier. It's very hard to hate sort of Orwellian Friday prayers in are there Friday prayers in Tehran or in? Yeah, they're in Tehran, aren't they? In Qum. That's kind of very, very, very scary stuff. And soccer is a kind of threat to that. Soccer is aligned there with the Green Revolution, and the national team played. Stolen election last year, the soccer team, the national team, somebody was playing with green armbands the next day, and then we didn't see those players anymore. And so soccer became one of the vehicles for that voice that was being repressed everywhere else. It became, we'll know eventually when the regime falls, just how important it was, as it was in South Africa, indeed. Soccer was terribly important.
And the Iraq team winning the Asian championship, too.
Yeah, it would be very interesting to know, because a lot was written about the surge, and the two sort of coincided, but the surge wasn't doing terribly well until after Iraq won that championship. It would really be interesting to know what effect that had. Again, we won't know properly for years. Somebody will write about it eventually. But I was very struck by that. Yeah, 2007.
Well, it's been great having you here on The People's Game, David Winter. David Winter is the author of Brilliant Orange, The Neurotic Genius of Dutch Soccer, as well as Those Feet, A Sensual History of English Football. David Winter, thank you so much for joining us here on The People's Game.
My pleasure.
That's The People's Game radio show for today, July 1st, 2010. I want to thank Fernando Romero and both of our guests, Alex Bellos and David Winter. And remember, you can hear the entire David Winter interview at www.thepeoplesgame.org. I'm Alan Minsky. This is The People's Game.
You ask me, am I happy? Well, let's matter of fact, I can say that I'm ecstatic, 'cause we all just made a pact. We've agreed to get together.
live. Your destination is the brightest star. If you know that you will be jamming until the break of dawn, touching the fire.